Okay, we will get underway with the Senate revenue hearing. Thank you. And where, Senator Brzezinski? We moved this for him, and there he is from yesterday to today. So this is a hearing that I've actually wanted to do for quite a while. It's we have, and I think I've benefited from this, we have done a number of exercises around the budget where we are tasked with coming up with anywhere from 20 to 50 to 100 to, in the worst times, several hundred million dollars in cuts to the budget. And I thought it's always been a helpful exercise. I think every member of the legislature has had to go through that exercise, and I've always found it to be a very helpful exercise to help prioritize at least where are my priorities in terms of investments and where would I make cuts if I had to. So the purpose and my goal would be, we'll see if we can get this done by noon or one today after we hear, I think, some pretty thoughtful testimony lined up, is could we do the same on the tax expenditure front, set a modest goal of $50 million that we would cut from the tax expenditure report if required to do so. It is an exercise that I think will be helpful to us to at least get a sense of where five of the 30 state senators are on, if they had to cut $50 million out of the tax expenditure, where would they go for that $50 million? With that, we've set this up as more of an exercise than a traditional hearing. I think we're going to hear from a couple of panels. Paul's provided some good worksheets, and my goal would be to fill that whiteboard up right there with at least some ideas and some numbers attached to them of where you would go if you had to find money in this very thick book. Paul, yeah, I guess I should say Dr. Warner, you were...
No, please.
Your PhD just was...
Paul. Just Paul, right? Yeah. Just a couple of things for the committee. This isn't really directly relevant to today's discussion, but we've prepared, Mary Ayala's done the work on preparing a research report on enterprise zone programs. And, you know, I think that's an example of some of the kind of in-depth analysis that I think will be helpful as you look at tax expenditures and our policies in the past. So I hope you'll find that useful for you. The House will be discussing it later this afternoon. In terms of the sheets in front of you, we just did a couple of things. on the kind of menu sheet that's the one page, we divided up the income tax expenditures into three categories. First of all, we deleted things that were in the Constitution. For example, exclusion of Social Security income in Oregon, we didn't put that in, just thinking that would be a step beyond what your exercise is today. And we excluded things that were in federal law that couldn't be changed. For example, taxation of interest on U.S. securities. in terms of breakdown, we have three categories. One is federal exclusions, and we just capped that at $5 million or more. And federal exclusions, of course, are things that are not reported directly on income tax returns. So I think if you're looking at those, I think you're looking at a different set of administrative or enforcement issues. Department of Revenue wouldn't have a federal return to go to find this kind of data. They would have to develop another enforcement mechanism. The second middle category there is federal deductions of $5 million or more, and these are usually the things you look at when you talk about reconnect policies. And these federal deductions, we do by and large have the information. You'll notice the familiar elements of Schedule A. Those of you who have been working on your income tax return, itemized deductions are going to show up here as federal deductions. So the Department of Revenue would have access to that kind of information on federal returns and could require it pretty easily to enforce. The third category are Oregon-only provisions. So these would be credits or federal subtractions, state subtractions that are in addition to whatever federal changes there are. So That's a different category solely under statutory authority in your decision-making capacity. So those are the three categories to look at. We did, anticipating that there may be more discussion around the Oregon-only credits and subtractions, we did summarize that for you in a little one-page, two-sided printout here that has one sentence description of each of those. Everything on the table has the tax expenditure number on it, so you can refer that back to your book if you have want to look at what that's referring to. And so Chris Salinex put all this together for us. And Chris did a lot of work on this, on the book itself, when he's at Department of Revenue, so he's very familiar with the content of it.
Yes.
So this page is just the third column, a little bit of expansion. A quick question, what's the total dollar amount of this one? And there's a reason why I'm asking that. It could become obvious later.
Mm-hmm.
Or is there a...
A lot.
Yes, I know it's a lot.
Senator, if you look at Oregon subtractions, and this would include those that are less than $1 million, too, which aren't going to add to much, but for 2005-07, subtractions alone were $1,262 million. Credits were $1,242 million. So the combined total of subtractions and credits is right about $2.5 billion. That would be for 2005-07 by name. So that's the subtractions and credits only. There's a little table on page 5 in your book that gives the summary of all the tax expenditures. But of course, you'll see on the dollar amounts, the dollar amounts are bigger from the federal side, okay. Exclusions and deductions on the federal side.
Other thoughts, or Senator Starr, anything before we dive in? Representative Haas, I know your committee is meeting as we speak. Please bring up your... I think we have two panels to lead off, and then we'll go into public testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and senators and fellow joint revenuers. Representative Mark Haas, District 27. I spent a great deal of time going through this book that Dr. Warner was just talking about, and I just want to give you a little bit of an overview of sort of my approach to this issue. The first bill that I ever got passed into law down here was a bill that offered tax credits to employers who set up scholarships for their employees and their kids. And I thought it was a good idea. Everybody wants to help kids get into college, and it was a meeting of business and kind of a private and public venture. I felt really good about it. The governor signed it into law, and I got my picture in the paper, and it seemed like everything was good in the world. But I did that totally in a vacuum. That legislation went through without anybody ever taking into consideration what the university system was doing with scholarships or what other scholarship deductions or credits already existed. And since I've been watching this after 6 years in the Revenue Committee, I realized that's how a lot of things get into this book. They're all well-intended. They all tend to be good ideas, but they are all unrelated to what else has passed. And we've really got 352 tax credits or deductions in this book with absolutely no connection or strategy to the others. And I think that's kind of the problem here. We've got $2.5 billion that we hand out every year in well-intended, well-meaning tax expenditure reports. But I think it would be a useful exercise if the legislature could say, all right, we're going to sunset everything in this book and get rid of all of it. Here's $2.5 billion of credits to start over. And if you did that, you would set up a criteria, say, okay, here's the kinds of jobs we'd like to create and promote, and we'll put in some tax incentives to do that, or education, or helping. We were just talking about housing affordability, and we'd set up this kind of criteria and have a coordinated strategic approach to tax expenditures instead of sort of the collection that we have now that goes back over 100 years. My favorite is the tax credit we give out for panning for gold that was put into law in 1913 and still exists. And probably somebody at the time thought it was a good idea, and now it's given out to mostly hobbyists who pan for gold. But I don't think it's in the best interest of our state to spend $3 million every biennium, which is what that costs, to help hobbyists pan for gold. My hobby is skiing, yours might be bird watching, and while those are great hobbies, I don't think it's in the best interest of the state to, or I should say, we could spend the money better if we put it into research and development or whatever. So I just think it's beyond time that we take a more strategic approach to these kinds of tax expenditures here that you see in this book, and do a more thorough evaluation and an auditing of what we do have to see whether it's working. And I've always been amazed that the hairdressers board is scrutinized down in the Ways and Means process, but $1 million tax credits go through a legislative session every session with barely a shrug of the shoulders. So that's just a little overview. I've been very close to the subject the last few years, and I thank you for taking the time to hear me out, and especially you, Mr. Chair, to look at this issue and make it a more central issue.
Thank you. Senator Schultz.
About a quarter of a century ago, now U.S. Congressman Earl Blumenauer had the idea, similar to yours, of sunsetting everything after about three biennium. We'll set a sunset date out three biennium and have everybody come in and make their case. Did you talk to him at all about his idea and what happened to it? It obviously didn't become law, or things would look radically different. I just discovered that recently. Somebody just educated me on the subject. I was wondering if there's something to be learned from that past.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shields, I didn't know that about Congressman Blumenauer, but I did have legislation in the last two sessions that would set up something akin to a base closure commission on these tax breaks, because as you know, it takes a 3/5 vote to sunset or eliminate one of these, and it's really easy to get a strong constituency for oyster growers or whatever it is in here, probably even gold miners, to preserve those, and it's just very difficult for the legislature to undo one of those. And I think it would make sense to have a recommendation of outside accountants, analysts, and to really, really audit these things and put them in a priority and come back the next session and have the legislature say, well, here's what we're going to fund, this top 50 of the 300 or whatever it may be. I really do think these things are crying out for an independent analysis. You see evaluations written at the end of most of these in this report, but they're not thorough evaluations in most cases. They're usually written by the agency that administers them, and that's certainly not the kind of objective evaluation that you'd want to have.
Right. And just on the same score, when we were getting an hour ago the corporate kicker numbers, the thought was definitely resonant in my mind is, could you take that same amount of money, forget the question of is it going to go back, seed that. Could you take that same amount of money and invest it in Oregon companies or incentives to grow here in Oregon rather than the structure that we have today? And I think that would be an interesting question that at least takes some of the political heat out of the question of a corporate kicker and just has a more rational discussion of, is this the best way to incent job growth in Oregon? I think it's in the same, at least, spirit of your recommendation of get out of where the money, but is this, are we actually getting what we want out of some of these tax breaks? Ms. Wimmer.
Thank you, Senator Deckard, Chair Deckard, and committee members for your record. I'm Lori Wimmer Whalen, representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 45,000 members. And I also come here today wearing the hat for the second biennium of three as the chair of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, which is a group, an ad hoc group, I would say, of 100-plus organizations, individuals, and even a couple government offices that have formed for the last three legislative sessions to shine a bright light on the revenue issues, particularly those that you're discussing today. Our members believe that responsible management of state resources require not only a disciplined approach to budgeting for programs down in Ways and Means, but also budgeting for these tax expenditures authorized by the revenue committees. And to that point, I would say that, as you probably know, 57 cents of every tax dollar levied in Oregon goes out, is foregone revenue in the form of these tax expenditures, which makes it, by definition, the largest line item in your state budget. So to that end, we echo the remarks of Representative Haas and thank him for his leadership as well as yours on this issue. The key focus of the Oregon Revenue Coalition, and I have given you the purple glossy packet filled with information that I hope you will find useful as you conduct this exercise, our focus has been to limit the proliferation of tax breaks because obviously hundreds of proposals are introduced every legislative session to add to that list of 350-some-odd. In fact, I think it may be more than 352 now as a result of the 2005 session. We also believe that the most important thing in this exercise of examining the tax expenditures is to identify and refine criteria for assessing those breaks. Are they good public policy, or are they the result of a good lobbyist? Do they represent the best way to seek that the enactment of that public policy, or is a direct program expenditure rather than a tax break program expenditure a better way to get that same result if it is in the state's interest to pursue that? Those are some of the kinds of questions that I think make sense to ask as you engage in this process, and it's certainly what we have done as a part of the coalition's work. We also believe that our work plan includes developing strategies for revenue recovery because, after all, the majority of our members represent human services, public safety, public education, other key and critical services that we believe Oregonians desire. And so we believe that if we can look at revenue policy to boost the state's investment in those program areas to the sufficiency level, that we will have made a contribution to help in that discussion. And finally, our work plan includes providing education on the subject to both the media and the public at large. And in that end, we work very closely with our sister organization, Our Oregon, which works outside of the legislative arena primarily on those same issues. You'll find in your packet a study that we did in 2003, we being Tim Nesbitt, who was then the president of the AFL-CIO, and myself, that took a look at those very issues. And excerpted from that, I also have a list of criteria. As I mentioned before, as you pursue the best possible policy for examining those tax breaks, it would seem to us that you ought to have a sense of what the most important public purposes are that those tax breaks allege they will accomplish, and not only assess whether those are still the state's priorities, but whether or not those tax breaks get that job done. And we've shared with you our list, and they include such things as promoting public education and middle-class home ownership, alleviating poverty, helping working poor with child care, creating good jobs, and so on. And you will find that list in your packet. We know that the public expects services to be expediently and accountably and adequately provided, and we really thank you for this opportunity to showcase the fact that it's not necessary to make Oregonians choose between feeding poor children and educating them, or to make them choose between Head Start and high school. There is another way to reach a line of adequacy for funding these vital services. In our report, you will see that we also took a look at those tax breaks that purport to create good jobs. And we looked at both. We divided up the list, by the way, by beneficiaries and purpose first, because we thought that made the most sense. That's how we sorted those. And of course, we had a category that set aside those that are done for administrative expediency, public lands, those kinds of things you wouldn't touch because, for one reason or another, they make no sense to even contemplate taking them off the books. But we looked at those beneficiaries, and we looked at the purposes they purport to serve, and tried to take a look at particularly the job creation ones, the ones that purport to stimulate the economy, thereby creating jobs in some way. And we tried to consider whether or not the amount of money that was given out in those tax breaks resulted in a cost per job. And that's another piece of that study. Sure, that this is what it looks like. It goes into some detail because we think that if you're going to look at job creation tax breaks, it makes sense to see whether you can do that in an economically efficient way. Just as you look for program efficiencies on the ways and means budget side, it seems to us rational that you would analyze tax breaks in the same way to see if they produce that kind of efficiency. And I would argue accountability. For example, the strategic investment program tax break, which is a property tax break, typically has in effect clawback provisions or sideboards that if you don't meet the certain expectations that those tax breaks are supposed to offer as negotiated by counties, then you could actually lose the break. It could be withdrawn. It's an accountability measure. But I think it's just about the only one that has those kinds of accountabilities embedded in it. And we think that that makes some sense, too. As you look at any kind of reform you might do, take a look at whether or not you get an efficient return on your dollar, and whether or not there are accountabilities embedded in the program. We're pleased to say that this report has made the rounds, not only in Oregon, but elsewhere in the United States, and has been replicated by our allies and folks we don't even know who've taken a page out of our book, in effect, and done their own similar reports. That report remains, we believe that that careful scrutiny of these tax expenditures is essential when you determine whether the evidence exists to demonstrate that the outcomes they purport to achieve, in fact, have been, and whether a tax break is the most economically efficient means to get the public policy objective you're looking for. The coalition will continue to urge lawmakers to establish as methodical and routine a look at these tax breaks as they do every line item in every budget in the Ways and Means side. We believe that these are just a different flavor of government subsidy, and they have no more or less a rationale for automatic continuation as any other expense of government. In fact, during the debate of more draconian spending limits last year, I argued that if the legislature insisted on capping the services side, then in fairness, such a proposal ought to also have a cap on the tax expenditure side. Both are government programs, in effect, and if what is good for the goose ought to be good for the gander. I mean, if you think about it in that way, that's why they're called tax expenditures. They are an expenditure of government. In 2005, the Revenue Coalition requested a bill that was chief sponsored by Representative Peter Buckley, House Bill 3490, and he sent his apologies that he was unable to be here today. But I've included his bill, his backgrounder on it, and some other information about it in your packet as well. His bill had a more modest look at tax expenditure cancellation, more in the $50 million range, Mr. Chair, that you were originally seeking. It's a small handful of tax expenditures that might be characterized as the low-hanging fruit in that tax expenditure book. The bill would have recovered $115 million by 2005-2007 biennial estimates. These dollars are not one-time monies. They're sustained revenue, and I think that's an important point as well. That's part of what cancellation versus suspension of a tax break nets you. In fact, we repeatedly offered a full menu of options for tax expenditure cancellations at the coalition, as well as for means testing, phase-outs, suspensions and removals of such practices as carry forwards and virtual automatic sunset extensions. There are things that you could keep on the books, for example, but just exempt out for the very wealthy. That would be another way to harvest some revenues without actually removing the piece from the books. It's another idea for you. A longer list of those proposals is also in your packet, and it looks like this. And we circulated that also to the 2005 Legislative Assembly. While you consider how you may wish to proceed in anticipation of the 07 session, we would ask you consider our call for a thorough review and an ambitious plan to scale back the unaffordable level of less worthy tax expenditures on the books. This won't solve all Oregon's revenue woes, but it would restore much credibility in terms of citizen sense of fairness and common sense with our tax system. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share our thoughts with you, and we look forward to assisting you in any way on this project.
Thank you. Questions for Senator Whitsitt?
Thank you, Chair Decker. Thank you for this information. It's a shame we didn't get it early enough to study it before your presentation. Did you know Oregon affords its taxpayers about $8.8 billion in exclusions, deductions, adjustments, subtractions, and credits annually, or biannually? Of that amount, 97%, or about $8.5 billion, is from the personal income tax returns. Only about 3%, or about $300 million, is provided to taxpayers of corporate excise taxes. Only $300 million. Of the $8.5 billion in personal income tax deductions, exclusions, adjustments, and credits, about $6 billion are accounted for in the federal tax law. Of the $2.5 billion in Oregon-specific incentives, more than $2.1 billion is included in personal exemptions, federal income tax deductions, Social Security benefits, and federal pension income, leaving about $400 million for truly Oregon incentives. Okay? That's on the personal income tax side. The preponderance of the remaining incentives are targeted at the care of elderly, the disabled children, and the military. The 3% in state-specific incentives that are provided to corporations add only about $300 million. Nearly 80%, or about $230 million of those incentives, are also a result of the federal tax code, leaving about $70 million in play. Of the remaining $70 million in corporate incentives that are specific to the Oregon tax code, 93% are represented by local siting of research and development, pollution control, Oregon affordable housing credits, and renewable energy and conservation. When we understand the amount of money that is connected to our federal tax code and to other responsible provisions that help the most vulnerable Oregonians and protect the state's livability, the remaining credits, the deductions, exclusions, and adjustments are really not very significant. Not really much more than a rounding error in our budget. We heard this morning that 65% of taxable income is wages in Oregon, and that tax revenues increase 110% for each 100% increase in personal income. So more and better paying jobs will grow our tax revenue faster than any other factor. Conversely, policies that restrict or restrict the creation of family wage jobs will be counterproductive to our revenue stream. So my question to you is, do you advocate for us to disconnect from the federal taxing program? Or how would you get enough money in play here to make a significant difference? And I ask that without reading your material.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsitt, that's a wonderful question. And I would point out, first of all, that the statistics you cite are based on the status quo, your current tax policy, which you have the power to change. And disconnect is one way of doing it, and on an item-by-item basis. As you will no doubt remember, in the 2005 session, there was quite a conversation about that, and in fact you did vote to not be connected to the QPI manufacturing tax deduction. And of course during the recession we had a temporary disconnect of 3 years too to most of the provisions of the code. Those are things that you can do. That's one set of choices. You can also look at the particular tax breaks that we pointed out would be, as I said, the low-hanging fruit. I would acknowledge to you that this is not your billion-dollar solution, probably. Although there is another way of doing this. You can take a percentile, as I mentioned before, and this has some controversy to it because you're not now prioritizing based on the policy. You're doing kind of a meat cleaver approach. But a number of policymakers have suggested to me that they had a higher comfort level just saying that we would limit our total tax breaks to X percent, and that would be an across-the-board reduction in the amount of the break you could take without taking any of them off the books. It is another approach. It is a way to also harvest revenue without removing the tax policy altogether. So there are a number of ways you could take a look at that or take a slice at it. We've certainly advocated for a prioritized list based on criteria of the highest public values and also the most economically expedient ways to do it. But I don't think that the federal tax policy ought to dictate to Oregonians how they run their state. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Whitsett.
Thank you, Chair Decker. Disconnecting across the board from the federal policy, and incidentally, all of us did not vote that way. Disconnecting from the federal tax policy across the board has a number of negatives. One of those is it would be a huge boon for accountants because, again, we'd have to figure out both our federal and state income tax separately. And it would be a huge expense for the state also to determine what the federal government already does. So that's another thing that would have to be weighed in that equation, whether you're actually saving money by disconnecting because of the incredible increase in costs to determine that tax by the private sector and equally incredible increase in cost on the part of the government to make sure that it's being done right.
Mr. Chair and Senator Whitsett, while I acknowledge that those are some of the points that have been made typically in that debate, it is also true that, particularly on the corporate side, they actually deal with not only federal tax policy, but often 50 states or a number of states' tax policy if they're a multi-state operation and are regularly doing multiple returns with multiple variations. And not to sound unsympathetic to the challenges of filing complicated tax forms and perhaps happily to keep Representative Butler employed, I would say that there are complexities in the tax code irrespective of connection or disconnection, and there are other ways to approach this task. That's simply just one of the options on the table.
One further. Ms. Wimmer, if you look at the actual cost factors, there's $300 million in play approximately in corporate taxes, which are the complicated interstate and so forth. But there's $2.5 billion that private individuals and private companies have to deal with within those limitations. So I don't think they're insignificant. And you know, you may be unsympathetic to the corporate entity, but I am sympathetic to the private sector and to the individual who is going to have a substantial increase in their cost preparation and cost. Thanks.
Senator Jackert and Senator Whitsett, one of the points I would make is, again, this is current tax policy. The rate or the share, I would say, that corporations shoulder of the total tax load having declined in recent years from 18% in its heyday to less than 5% today. And that's certainly a trend that is a matter of tax policy, and that also could be reversed.
So, and Chris, welcome to the Revenue Committee. We're going to rename it the Revenue and Religion Committee because my experience has been, and I think this conversation is it's one that we have circled around, is my experience with the tax expenditure report is that, and I've walked into our caucus at least,
and had to say this, is that most of them I find are pretty darn good, and ones that I would not just support, I voted for and would defend as passionately. And my only question that I would put forth is, are there a few, and I see a list that you have compiled here, Lori, of 73.7, that at least bear discussion, that we ought to discuss and ask the question, just as we do on the budget side, is it getting us exactly what we want, or are there other avenues for 50 or 73.7? So what I hope to do, and I don't know who's compiling the list, Paul, but Representative Haas had one. There's five more here, because I hope after we get through a couple panels, and I know a couple individuals who've come to testify, I'd like to at least dive into those and get a sense of, is there any shared agreement that those are at least in play or ought to be examined here in the interim further?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to compile the list on the whiteboard.
Oh, boy. All right. Great. So you've got the list. I was going to task it with our intern from Klamath Falls, but you're off the hook. Synergy.
just a quick comment. As Lori was giving her testimony, she was talking about 57 cents out of every dollar, you know, goes for the expenditure. An old friend of mine was in your chair, Mr. Chairman, back in 1987. All right, that's coming up on 20 years. He was the chairman of the Senate Revenue Committee. I'm kind of interested, and maybe Paul can find us out, what would have the number been, say, 20 years ago? Rather than 57 cents, what was it 10 years ago? What was it 20 years ago? What was it 30 years ago? I mean, was it 50 cents of every dollar? Was it 25 cents of every dollar? Has this taken off exponentially in the last 20 years, or has it slowed down?
Senator, this report grew out of an interim study that the Legislative Revenue Office did following the 93 biennium. So we have a 93-95 estimate that we can take a look at and see how that would compare. But the statute that set up this particular report was actually passed in 95. So I'm not sure if I would have a comparable history. We could certainly look at individual tax expenditures and see what's happened to those historically. So we'll see what we can put together for you.
It would just be fascinating to know what that graph looks like, whether it's a fairly gentle slope or whether it's taken off. Or Senator, maybe it's actually gone down. I don't know what it is, you know, and I'd like to.
Okay.
Would that be informative to others other than me?
Yeah. Although I'm not sure fascinating is the word that comes to mind, but certainly informative. And
could be scary. What's your adjective?
Other questions or thoughts, or we'll move on to Ms. Coughlin.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chris Coughlin. I'm executive director of Our Oregon, a progressive nonprofit standing up for economic and tax fairness for all. Thank you very much for the opportunity to be here today. Mark and Lori have really laid out a lot of wonderful information for you to consider as you review the tax expenditures that are currently part of the tax code. I'd just like to spend a few minutes talking about priorities. The argument that by passing a new tax credit, you'll spur job creation is a mantra often heard from lobbyists during the legislative sessions here in this building. But I would urge you to read Rethinking Growth Strategies, How State and Local Taxes and Services Affect Economic Development by economist Robert Lynch before you vote on another tax giveaway whose goal is to attract new businesses and new jobs. His research is a wonderful foundation for the work that you are launching today and will help you frame a productive process to identify those tax expenditures which, while coveted by special interests, do not meet the priorities of Oregonians. Lynch analyzed hundreds of research studies and found little evidence that state and local taxation figures figure prominently into business location decisions. Since state and local taxes account for less than 1% of the cost of doing business, almost every other factor, including public services, plays a larger role in business decisions than did the taxes. In fact, if you look to our neighbor to the north, Many would argue we should try to emulate the economic growth and business climate that Washington has fostered. As you grapple with the decisions before you, it's critical to remember that Washington companies contribute to the public good through business taxes to a much greater extent than do corporations in Oregon. According to an Ernst & Young report on total state and local business taxes, Washington businesses pay half of all taxes collected in the state, while Oregon businesses contribute one-third of all taxes here. The greater share of business taxes in Washington has allowed our neighbor to make significant investments in key public services, such as higher education, investments that have eluded us thus far. The exciting thing about the process you're starting today is that it has the potential to shift the tide of declining corporate tax revenue, though we heard today tax revenue is growing in the revenue forecast, but with a kicker, obviously much of that will be refunded. And by making some changes in the tax code would allow us to make some of the investments that are essential for the future of our state. As you proceed, I urge you to please always remember the priorities of Oregonians: good schools, safe communities, access to affordable health care. As Lynch concludes his work, he states, quote, "The real lesson for legislators and local policymakers is that what makes a community a good place to do business looks a lot like what makes a community a good place to live. That means good schools, good police and fire protection, a modern and well-maintained transportation infrastructure, and good all-around public services. Instead of creating jobs, tax-cutting strategies that undermine government's ability to provide quality services can end up destroying jobs." And finally, when we consider the shift in the tax burden from corporate to individual taxpayers over the last several decades, it is difficult for someone to continue to say that Oregon's tax policy is anti-business. Corporations in Oregon are paying 71% less in state corporate income taxes as a share of the economy than they did in the late 1970s. In the 73-75 budget cycle, corporations paid 18.5% of all income taxes. In the current budget cycle, corporations are expected to pay approximately 4.6% of Oregon's taxes. And the decline in corporate income taxes in Oregon is indicative of a general decline in business taxes. As a share of the economy, total business taxes in Oregon have been cut in half since 1985. Ironically, Senator Deckard, the Tax Foundation report you mentioned earlier this morning, released this week, identifying so-called business-friendly tax policies, ignores jobs created, economic growth, healthy, vibrant communities, quality educational systems, or maintaining key public infrastructure, and only considers which state is winning the race to the bottom by cutting corporate taxes. Oregonians deserve better than that, and we urge you to make a real commitment to the exercise you are beginning today, to work with your colleagues to implement meaningful policy to not only end the expansion of corporate tax giveaways, but to eliminate some of the most egregious examples. With well over 300 tax expenditures, there's certainly plenty to review. I've listed on my testimony a few what we consider loopholes in some of the public purposes that we hear about with job creation for you to consider eliminating. These tax expenditures subsidize overseas operations, not jobs here in Oregon. Senator Witzig, we're very concerned about creation of living wage jobs here in Oregon and are concerned with tax expenditures that instead subsidize overseas operations. And so I've laid out a list here that's a combination of personal and corporate tax expenditures totaling $89.5 million, according to the last report. They would require some targeted disconnect from, in some cases, from the federal tax code. But we feel that this would enable Oregonians to help fund part of what we want and need in communities here at home, not overseas operations. Thank you for this opportunity. We look forward to working with you to help ensure a more equitable and fair tax system for all Oregonians, a system that allows us to make investments in our future rather than ones that caters to special interests. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Deckard. You know, statistics are interesting, but when you spoke of the ratio of personal tax to corporate tax in the state of Washington, what you didn't mention was that Washington has a 6.5% sales tax that primarily taxes the private sector, the personal income tax sector of the state, and Oregon has none. So you really need to put that into your presentation to balance that effort, because the Oregon has a high personal income tax because we don't have a sales tax.
Right, and the figures that I used with the 50% and the one-third include all taxes on the personal and business side, so it does factor in the sales tax in Washington, the lack of the sales tax here. And that's by Ernst & Young, a study that they did for a group called COST, that it's coming out of the Chamber of Commerce and is a coalition of multi-state corporations. So we felt that that was numbers that people would be comfortable using. Thank you.
Other questions or thoughts? Do y'all know offhand, I know the Washington legislature, well, it was the previous one, made some target investments, obviously in transportation, a big investment in transportation, mm-hmm. and a large gas tax mm-hmm. increase to do it. But they also made some target investments in education and higher education. And I know they used the state tax was one of the vehicles that they used to make those investments. Do you know, did they deal with tax credits? Do you know offhand, or Paul? Did they deal with tax credits at all, or was it just mainly those two revenue choices that they made? No.
Yeah, I don't know.
the main thing we know about, Mr. Chair, is the excise tax increases. They did adjust their liquor control revenue. Of course, they had a significant cigarette tax increase and the gasoline tax increase that you mentioned. So those were the three that I'm familiar with. Of course, when you look at their tax system, when they talk about tax expenditures, they're talking about sales tax exemptions.
Uh-huh.
And, it was interesting when we saw, for example, the SIP program was instituted in Oregon to encourage semiconductor investment, they responded with a sales tax exemption for high-tech capital equipment. And that, as a result, there was a, this kind of a competition going on. They're using their sales tax as their tax expenditures. They have developed tax expenditure estimates for their sales tax exemptions, and I can see if I can, and I'm pretty sure I can run that down for the committee, so you can take a look and see what kinds of things they would include in their tax expenditures.
Okay? We have our Washington envy. full force. Any other questions or thoughts? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair.
The next panel, who I think will agree wholeheartedly with this panel, is Mr. Schweinhart, Mr. Wilson, I think Mr. Lindquist. Jim, are you joining? Or you're welcome to.
I didn't ask Jim. He was on vacation for a couple weeks.
Jim, you didn't get asked because you were on vacation. I just left. So I hope you had a
penalty points.
Yeah. Everyone's been announcing their vacations. I have nothing to announce.
Yeah.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm J.R. Wilson. I represent the National Federation of Independent Business. Just to start off with my comments, first of all, my members have always bristled at the term tax expenditure because of its presumption that the money first belongs to government and then the private sector, when in fact my members feel very strongly that the money is generated with the private sector first, and that the but that being what it is, you would expect me as a business lobbyist to be stumbling all over myself asking for tax breaks for certain industries when I think, and Representative Hass will probably be chagrined because I didn't support his proposal two sessions ago. We've never supported an individual tax break. And it might be because of personal preference, but I've just always thought it was sloppy tax policy. We've been on record clearly supporting capital gains reduction because I think that is the rocket fuel that our economy needs. We've supported the Oregon Business Association with their investment tax credits, and we supported death tax reform as a matter of fairness. Now, those are the three tax issues that I think are consistent with good tax policy in general, but in terms of niche tax exemptions, we've just flat out never supported those. And it calls into question, you know, are there a bunch of corporate giveaways in the tax expenditure report? And as you alluded to, Mr. Chair, you could go down the list, and I've gone through this document 100 times wondering what I missed the time before. You know, I look at this, and every single one has a purpose that we could all say, yeah, that's something that's laudable, and probably perhaps we should be working toward, whether it's trying to achieve home ownership or some environmental stewardship goal, or reducing the cost of health care, or promoting college education. I mean, there's a laudable goal embedded in every single tax expenditure on the books. And there was mention of this foreign income. Well, in the previous testimony, well, you know, that is hopefully there to get Oregon companies to compete on an international basis. So it's not like that is without a laudable goal itself. So that's the difficulty when you talk about these tax expenditures, because at one time the legislature and the governor all came to agreement on these items that they were in fact good for Oregon. Now, as I read all of these, there are a couple in my mind that clearly don't measure up, or at least are fuzzy. And I don't think, if we can't talk about these, we can't talk about any of them. And when you talk about what we're trying to achieve with tax expenditures, I think you have to argue that, what is the political tax credit doing there? I think you should probably talk about, what about the Oregon Cultural Trust? What about things for that target film production? I mean, if we can't talk about these things, we can't talk about any of them. And those are the three, at least at the top of my mind, that I thought, well, you know, do they measure up to the goals that we're trying to achieve with our tax expenditure? And those you could probably draw a question mark around. But, in terms of what we're discussing today in the tax expenditure report, it's hard to argue against any of them, because they all purport to achieve something that's laudable and that we want for ourselves as a state. Do I think they should withstand scrutiny? Of course I do. But, you know, we undergo that process on a regular basis. For instance, my friend here to my right, Joe, I mean, very involved in the pollution control tax credit. But that issue is discussed each and every session since I've been here. So it's not that that has been without due attention session in and session out. So that's the extent of my testimony, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to answer questions.
Questions for Mr. Wilson. Mr. Schweinhardt.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhardt, Associated Oregon Industries. Appreciate the opportunity to appear before you today to discuss tax expenditures. But I am here to support of what is called a tax expenditure, a tax credit, but in reality, they're tax investments. They are investments for the economically sound Oregon, investments in jobs, and investments in communities throughout Oregon. A former director of the Portland Development Commission said it best a few years ago. The payback to a community for offering incentives to business is huge. We are getting the benefit of the fees they pay, the taxes they pay, the taxes their employees pay. It's basically a spark, not corporate welfare. If we don't do it, the impact of these kind of investments will go elsewhere. Dale Mahaffey, the former tax manager of ESCO Corporation, stated that tax incentives can make or break a company's decision to locate here. We need a cohesive and sound business tax strategy to ensure that our state attracts our most valued prize, family wage jobs. Tax incentives, investments, are about growing the economy. It's about telling business that Oregon values your company as part of our economy. If you remember, just last session, the Oregon legislature approved unanimously, I believe, the tax credits for the food processing industry in Oregon, an industry vital to Oregon's economy. Good public policy. You have also examined and approved all such investments in the past. Another such investment was the energy tax credit that I see on the list, and that goes mainly to small businesses and nonprofits such as schools. The Oregon Department of Energy estimates show that the project supported by the tax investment has increased economic output by over $14 million, annual wages by $4.4 million, and annual business income by over $900,000. Projects costing less than $20,000 account for over 75% of these projects. Income tax investment credits do make a difference for small business. Let's not forget the private sector can more efficiently spend a dollar than government. Last year, and I was going to talk about Jim Craven and his study he did last year, but I'm going to let him do that. I wasn't clear if he was going to be here this morning. But let me finish by, other states are now looking beyond tax credits to strengthen their economic base. In Ohio, they just approved $500 million to assist and strengthen and recruit manufacturing to their state. In New York, the governor is recommending cutting taxes, increasing, reducing the business income tax by 10%, and or eliminating the alternate minimum tax and allowing business the immediate expensing of any new capital investment in their state. And I don't want to discuss what's happening to the north, as you already have in Washington, as they at one point were tied with us for the highest unemployment, and now I believe their unemployment is below the national average. So what is this? It's an investment. Tax credits, tax expenditures are investments. And is anybody looking at the return on that investment? We talk about how much we spend on that investment, but like tax credits for energy, you get quite a return. Second of all, let me finish by saying I would certainly support getting rid of the panning for gold tax credit if it's still there. And if the committee is looking forward to those type of credits, we would certainly be interested in reviewing those. But in reality, as JL said, these credits were put in for a reason, and until we find some reason not to have them, then we would support them. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So just the immediate question, maybe JL or Joe. So you mentioned a couple from the political contribution to the panning for gold that at least should be in play. And I certainly wouldn't hold you because this is just kind of a shot from the dark. But if this committee decided and that we would 50 to 75 million and the list is negotiable. You mentioned a couple. The previous panel mentioned a couple. Do you think that's a good and appropriate conversation for us to have of how could we invest this? How could we perhaps, in legislative jargon, split it where that half would go back to the taxpayers and half would go into investments that you could at least get mutual agreement around ought to be made? Do you think... I'm trying to, in some ways, test the political waters. Is that...
Thank you, Chairman Deckert and members. I think every tax credit, every government expenditure ought to withstand the light of day in terms of its effectiveness. I am not for spending money on things that don't work. And I think, as the previous panel mentioned, maybe Representative Hess, some of these tax credits, you get the sense that it's just a cursory analysis of these things and whether it works, because according to the tax expenditure, all but about one or two of these things work quite well. And it's hard for me to believe that out of 200 tax credits, that they're all achieving their desired end to perfection. And so, I am all for, reviewing and making sure these withstand the light of day. The one thing I don't understand is this compared, that corporations aren't paying their fair share or that corporation taxes as a percentage of the total tax burden has consistently decreased. And this is something I wanted to mention before. Out of 12,000 of my members, I'm guessing 10 to 11,000 are S-Corps. That means they're no less businesses than your Target or Walmart, but the income from that business flows through on the director's or the owner's income. For example, with KJO Radio, we own in Grants Pass, the income from that business is reflected on my father's and my uncle's income taxes. So it's individuals. But they're not. It's business income that's reflected on individual tax return, and that's kind of with the proliferation of LLCs and F corps. That comparison doesn't seem to me to hold water anymore because you have so many of these businesses filing taxes as S corps.
Mr. Chairman, I think some of that will depend. Obviously, an exercise to look at these certainly doesn't hurt anything. I seriously think when you start to look at tax credits, you have to look at the effect it has. You have to look at the return you get on the dollar. And I think, all in all, when you start looking at these things, I think you'll find out they have a pretty good return. And if there's some out there that isn't, and there's some out there that the state's wasting money, certainly it's something that should be looked at. But it's difficult to – you have to take everything into account. If you're going to start looking at these things, you got to look at them all the way through. Not just a precursory, they're getting this much, they shouldn't get that, so let's get rid of it. So you have to look at all aspects of it.
Back from vacation. Where'd you go?
Mr. Chair, Jim Craven, American Electronics Association. For the record, the Big Island of Hawaii for the first time, and if you haven't been there, I'd highly recommend it. Nothing like walking across the crater of a volcano or steam still coming out of the ground underneath your feet. It's quite an experience. So, anyway, thank you.
We were just working, Jim.
I'm just going to make a few comments. At the end of my testimony, I printed off some copies last night of a piece I did way back in January of 05 during the session in response to a press conference that the House Democrats had on this specific issue, and that's what kind of led me to spend a Friday afternoon at my house with the Bible here, the tax expenditure book, and just go through and look at some of the numbers, some of the macro conclusions one can come to. Actually, Senator Whitsitt read a lot of those conclusions into the record, the macro conclusions. And again, this is a difficult subject to do on. It's easy to talk about 527 tax breaks. It's harder to repeal the child care tax credit. And that's the dilemma in front of you. And the various versions of this exercise that I've been part of over the last 10 years, you know, always comes down to that. It's easy to say, look, there's $9 billion, and look, there's $527, and look, some of them have been on the books for 20 years. And when it comes down to it, we repealed fish gleaning several years ago. So that's how this exercise does tend to go from the very general to like, wow, we ought to do something to the who, which one do we want to put up on this board and vote on? And that's it's a difficult exercise to go through. A couple comments. We have done this exercise several times. Doesn't mean we shouldn't do it again. But I think what we've learned in the past when we've gone through this exercise is that most of the tax expenditures, if you look at the macro numbers, do flow from connection to the federal code. That's a huge hunk of what we're talking about. So unless we want to go through what we went through this last session, which is selective disconnect and fighting over HSAs and QPI and that kind of thing, there's some money there. I wouldn't advise that it's a good policy for Oregon to do those selective disconnects, but that's where the bulk of this money is. The other fact we've learned is that most of these expenditures flow through to individual Oregon taxpayers. If you look at in my analysis, it's just income tax expenditures. I didn't do the same thing with the host of property tax expenditures. But most of the debate, most of the data you're looking at here are income tax provisions. There's a host of property tax provisions also outlined in the book. But if you look at income tax provisions and the total amount, remember a tax expenditure is defined as any deviation from a perfectly pure tax code. So it's deductions, exclusions, credits, it's all that stuff. If you look at all that and you look at the total numbers that you've been hearing in this macro analysis, 97% goes to individuals. And that's like on page 6 of the book. This is not my own independent analysis. It's outlined in the book. So the first thing you come to in that is, wow, this is individual Oregonian taxpayers that we need to go dig into if we're really going to mine or harvest, I think was the word from previous panel. You're going to be harvesting big money if you're looking for big money from individual Oregonians, not from corporations and businesses. The second, if you just look at Oregon provisions, which is a small subset of this big book, things that are Oregon law as opposed to connecting to the federal code. My analysis of Oregon provisions is about 95% individuals, 5% business. So again, the macro money here, if you're looking for big money, is taking away things from individual Oregonians that they have come to count on. And if you look at the list that's in the piece I'll hand out, it's the same numbers that you see in the stuff Paul gave you. There's some ones that personal exemption credit, employer-paid medical benefits, cafeteria plan benefits. I mean, you can come really quick to about 7 out of the $9 billion with stuff that I would say sort of are third rail type of issues that you probably don't even want to get into, like home mortgage and other things like that. I think, and finally, that I think in the reviews that we've done in this process, people have come to general conclusions that, geez, there are constituencies and there are rationales, and people will come out to defend what's in current law. Things got in current law because there was constituencies for them, And many of these have been subject to a sunset review process. The issues that I worked on, none have a lifetime. You know, we've come back every other session, every third session, and had the debate and made the case, and people have voted. I think the idea, Representative Hass's idea of the sort of base closing analogy, I think is a dangerous one in the sense of saying that Oregon tax expenditures and tax program provisions should be handed over to an independent commission to take an analysis of, and then perhaps with the base closing analysis give you an up or down vote, yes or no, on all the bases. That's the way the congressional thing works. Congress doesn't get to save the Texas base and shut down all the other ones. It's up or down. To do that with, you know, to extend that analogy to this exercise, I think would be like saying, you know, maybe we ought to subject what happens in this room normally, our expenditures, to an independent commission. Maybe you should take a look at the way Oregon spends money and then give you an up or down vote. I don't think anybody would be sort of excited about that, about independent people, because you are the policymakers. You're elected by Oregonians to come here and wrestle through this stuff. So, I think the idea of having this thrown off to an independent group probably isn't my idea of why we have a legislature and how our democracy works. A couple more issues and I'll shut up. One is your question, Mr. Chair, about is this a reasonable exercise to go through? Certainly. I have one caution that's sort of the way Congress does it caution, which is the netting idea of combining, well, Congress says, we'll extend the federal R&D tax credit, for instance, but as part of that process, we have to go find the money to pay for it. Of course, then they just spend deficits anyway. I mean, they pretend to do this netting thing where they, if they're going to extend a tax provision, they cut a program, and then they just ignore it and run up the deficit anyway. But I think it gets a little dicey in terms of the direct tying of saying we're going to repeal these $50 million of tax credits and then we're going to spend the money over here. It's not an unreasonable thing to think about. I think it's fraught with some interesting tensions that you might think about as you go forward with the exercise. I think finally it comes down to if you're going to do the exercise, you got to eventually put something on this board. That's the hard thing. Second you put things on the board, the room fills up. And that's the way it's happened in the past. Not a whole lot of people here today when it's macro and theoretical, but as soon as you start putting stuff on the whiteboard, the people who believe in those programs will show up, then they'll make their case, and then you can dispose of them, you know, however you want. So I think that's my final comment, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the chance to come here today.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Craven?
So, Jim, the immediate question for me that comes to mind is, so if you're sitting, and I'll make this a hard question for you, you're sitting with the Executive Committee of AEA, and you're looking at, because as I did this exercise, or at least roughly did it in my head the last couple of days of policy choices, political contribution, tax credit being one of them, there's $10 million, this life insurance one, or the panning for gold, I can get myself, and I didn't mention pollution control, but I can get there too. I can get myself to 50. And then if I was sitting with the AEA board, or I would like to make the argument, is it a better investment to be putting into engineering education? Certainly for me, and ONAMI is something that is going to return, hopefully, and it's already has, leverage private and federal dollars and is returning economic growth to the state. And to me, that's a very good conversation to have, an important one, but you actually probably have more experience than most in the state of actually delving through this report. And what is your feeling? Do you think there's 20 million, 10 million, 50 million, not the macro but the micro, and we're gonna put it on the board at least, and Jail's, at least some of his recommendations, I think will at least get up there for whether it's the political or the cultural trust. What is your feeling?
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a difficult. There's other than the multitude of federal reconnect issues, and you know, Lord knows we spent a lot of time on that last session. There are a number of provisions in the federal code that my folks would probably not want you to disconnect from. When it comes down to Oregon-specific items, there's only a few that we've advocated for on this list over the years. I think it's difficult to ask any of us to advocate to gore someone else's ox. To say, well, if here's a list and there's $70 million and none of them really hurt your clients, could you come in and be for it? And I'm thinking, well, then I'm being for repealing something else that maybe someone else is passionate about. So that's a little hard to do, to ask you to be in favor of, you know, getting somebody else's,
pollution control.
So I think that's difficult. I think the other thing is, you know, again, I think Senator Whitsitt used the phrase rounding error. You know, 50 to 70 million bucks is, you know, while it'd be a lot for any of us in the room to have in our personal net worth, if the goal is to find some money to spend on needed public services, I would suggest that there may be different conversations that can get there. I'm going to run off a list, and I'm not saying I'm advocating for them on behalf of my clients. But you could talk about corporate minimum. You could talk about corporate kicker. You could talk about a couple of things, very easy to understand. A lot of people would help you make the case for them that would raise significant dollars. So if the goal is more money, there are other ways to get there. And again, I'm not advocate anything on that list, but I mean, there's significant dollars available in any of those approaches, rather than kind of going through the heartburn of this process. So,
sure.
Yeah, Senator Vazansky.
Yeah, I was going to wait and have Mr. Lundquist give his presentation, because knowing where he's been on some of this issues as to getting education funded and stuff like that. But Jim, you brought up the point, so I'm going to go ahead and just dive into it. I'd like to know each of your positions as to some of the things outside of the box, just like Mr. Cravens has talked about. I mean, maybe we don't look at the 352 that are out there, but instead look at the corporate kicker. I mean, here's the situation when I came in 95, if I remember correctly, when it kicked, over 50% of it was a credit, and then in 97 it was just under 50%. Now we're having an anticipation of 36%. And why isn't that money staying... let's say invested in Oregon, when I realized that, and Paul can correct me if I'm wrong, but last time we went through this, about 70% of that corporate money leaves the state. It goes to some other state where it's invested there or wherever. Where it's not invested is here in Oregon, in schools, and maintaining that we have a job force that can actually fill these jobs if these corporations are coming in and benefiting within our state.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd like to know where y'all are at on that. I mean, that's outside the box.
Senator Posansky, I do just want to respond to one piece of what you just said about the going to out of state, because this is sort of a particular issue that bothers me. When we talk about where, say, the corporate kicker, or first of all, where the money goes is a factor of where it comes from. So if you say the money goes, quote, out of state, then it means the people paying the bulk of the taxes are from out of state. But I think what it means is multi-state companies, not necessarily out of state.
Jim, let me finish, because you're reframing the issue. The reality, you know it and I know it, corporations are out of state. If they're headquartered there, the money goes back there, they're more likely to invest in their area and put money into their schools and do all the bells and whistles there as compared to doing it in other outposts where they have ongoing business.
Right. Senator, I haven't seen an analysis that tries to actually show the geographic out-of-state part. All I'm reacting to is that a number of the leading corporations in Oregon who employ Oregonians, who are great pillars of our Oregon society, are multi-state corporations who may have their corporate headquarters in a different location. But when Intel is an out-of-state corporation, Hewlett-Packard is an out-of-state corporation, Freightliner is an out-of-state corporation, I think Harry and David at this point is owned out of the state. When you look at this analysis of who gets the corporate kicker, it goes to sometimes companies located out of state, meaning they have a corporate headquarters, but they may also be part of our state. That's all I'm trying to point out, is that Intel and Hewlett-Packard and Freightliner and these companies are here. Are they located out of state corporately, perhaps? And so, I mean, I'd be interested in seeing that analysis, as opposed to a company that, say, Detroit automakers. They are clearly out of state who have operations in Oregon. And partially what we've done with the corporate apportionment issue, the single sales factor, is, in a sense, put some of the additional burden on those purely out-of-state companies who just sell into Oregon but don't do anything here for employment and the society. So anyway, I'm wandering off, but I'm just a little sensitive the last year to this out-of-state corporation thing, because some of my biggest members are technically out-of-state corporations, but they employ thousands of Oregonians, so that's my only point.
I'd ask you to go back to your corporations that are from out of state and ask them, were their headquartered out of state, how much gifting do they do for nonprofits and other organizations within their headquarter geographic location versus other places?
Right.
Because the studies I've seen and the stuff I've done on nonprofits, it's wherever you have a corporate headquarters, they're much more likely to give to that community than they are to where they may have an outpost.
Sure. Senator, except in the... I would agree with that analysis, except in the sense of those, quote, corporate out-of-state companies who have significant investments here. I mean, HP and Intel and such are pillars of their local communities just because of their geographic size. I mean, there's more people working for Intel in Oregon than any other place in the world, even though they're a Santa Clara, California corporation. So I'm not arguing with you. I think you're right. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Przanski, just to take it one step further, if you look at Intel, for instance, they just invested how much money in expanding their operations, and that came from corporate headquarters. And I don't think we can sit here and tell you, or anybody can tell you, what those corporate decisions are made and how they're made and who decides invest in which state. But we do know that 30% of those returns do go to Oregon companies, and they probably are invested here. So there is a return on some of that kicker directly that we can point to. As far as the kicker goes, to AOI, the important issue here is the economy, business growth, and helping support a strong economic foundation. If you're going to look at trying to do something with the kicker, then you should do something to invest in business. You should do something to strengthen our economy, so if we have this economic downturn, it may not be as bad. Do something to invest in the economy so we can grow stronger like a lot of other states are right now. That's where we think you need to be. And we think if you're going to do anything like that, then a lot of that income, because it is potentially a one-time thing, so you don't want to put it in recurring cost. You want to take it and invest it somewhere. We think that can be done. And we think it makes sense to help business strengthen our economy.
Mr. Chair, let me follow up. Joe, would you agree that investing in education, making sure that we have a job workforce that are Oregonians to fill these jobs, would be a good investment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Przanski, certainly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Przanski. Be perfectly candid on the kicker question. I think we know that there's a ballot measure or two or three that are floating this idea. NFIB will most likely be neutral. We will fall on our sword for the personal kicker. The corporate kicker is something that we've always seen value in the kicker as a measure of some sort of spending curb, to be quite honest. Not so much in where the money goes, but it's not exactly rational, but a spending curb, a spending curb of some sort.
Take that point on the tape, please.
a spending curb of some sort. And I would simply say, you know, when we were going through the exercise in 2002 with the special session, you know, if there was $1 billion, which was the amount refunded in kicker rebates, if there was $1 billion embedded in the budget that we had to cut from, our situation would have been much more more dire. And I think that that's a very rational argument, and I would much rather see a kicker in place than something like what they was suspended in Colorado. So we've always valued the kicker from that point of view. I can tell you we would probably not be supportive if that money went back into the general fund just to be distributed. However, we would probably insist on significant business involvement or targeting that money towards some business cause. The issue came up with regard to the corporate minimum taxes. Be very honest with everybody, my dog in that fight has always been with S-Corps. I'm not willing to see S-Corp corporate minimums increase. It is my understanding that some of the larger companies, just to avoid embarrassment or bad publicity, would like to see their corporate minimums increase. And for the big guys, if they want to do that, then be accommodating to them. To be very honest with regard to the S-Corps, my interest in protecting the 90% of my members who are S-Corps, you have to, this is flow-through income that they pay 9% personal income tax on anyway. So why would there be discussion about increasing minimum taxes on S-Corps? So that is my interest. My interest is protecting S-Corps. I see Joe just really didn't like what I had to say. It's not that I say to increase the C-Corp. I'm just saying the S-Corps just does not make sense, and that's really where my heart is on that issue.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, if I may just comment briefly on that minimum tax. Again, $10 is difficult to defend, but at the same time, a lot of reasons that people weren't paying that money was because at the time they weren't making money. Mm-hmm. Now they're making the money. The corporate tax, again, JL has a good argument, but to increase that again would make sense to invest the money in the economy to make it better. And yes, part of that may be education, but that's not the only thing.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Bosansky.
Just for historical perspective, the corporate minimum when it first came on the books in 1929 was $25, and it's been $10 since the Depression. Seems like we could maybe do a little modification there, get it back to maybe at least where it was.
We got a deal, 25.
25. Put it on the board. Put it on the white.
Sold.
Lynn Lindquist.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lynn Lindquist from the Oregon Business Association. A lot of good things have been said here today as far as from the business community. I'm not going to repeat them. I think I'm just going to start, since it's on everybody's mind right now, where Senator Prasansky's comment was, or question was, as far as corporate minimum and kicker. Before I do that, I think we need to be careful we don't talk about apples and oranges here. Tax expenditures, which is the basic idea for today, that's talking about a very specific issues, but so many of what we're talking about is really tax reform, or it's a bigger, more global thing that Senator Prasansky just talked about, and I think both are worthy. I just think that we should not go down the path of thinking this is going to be some kind of tax reform, because it's not about tax reform. The kicker, capital gains, those kind of things, now that's I think tends to get more in that arena. Having said that, as far as the kicker is concerned, again, we need to analyze, are we talking about tax policy? Are we talking about revenue that we're after? Because the tax policy has basically said in Oregon that the corporations are going to pay 6.6, I think, is that right, Dr. Warner? And that's our tax policy for corporations, I believe. Now, the kicker, that's a different issue. That's talking about excess revenue that came in only because the economists were right. It has nothing to do with anything else. So I think if we're going to analyze that, we need to analyze that on that basis. The Oregon Business Association would support doing away with the corporate kicker. We've taken that position publicly before. Now, that's not a carte blanche situation. Some of the others have talked about here is what we're going to do with the money. You know, are we going to put it? We believe that investment is the key word that we've lost out of the Oregon tax analysis or just expenditures, revenue. We don't talk about investments. That's a key word I think we need to talk about. And if we relate that to the kicker issue, then I think that's okay. You know, let's go there. Might just diverge a little bit from this. I don't know if any of you read, maybe 6 weeks ago, Doug Bates in Oregonia had a column talking about things are getting better in Oregon. And one of the things he talked about was you have that 30-member panel that's going to, you know, be find utopia for all of you, so you're going to have a really great session next time. Somewhat tongue-in-cheek. But anyway, in that process, he was talking about one of the things they were that this panel might propose is annual sessions. And he was complaining about the corporate kicker, and he's saying, you know, annual sessions would reduce the amount of the corporate kicker because you don't make a projection for such a long period of time. That's absolutely true. And to me, that's just ludicrous. Because if a corporate kicker is an issue, then you deal with the corporate kicker. We don't have you come in here every 12 months instead of every 24 months, so that we can now have a corporate kicker that's more, you know, in tune. Mm-hmm. So my point is simply this. That's tax policy. And those are the kind of things I think we ought to be looking at. When you look at, and others have already talked about, you know, the large ones, if you're going to start getting to this revenue tax policy issue, they're ones you can't touch. Just for example, however, I think we need to be aware when those large ones have some changes, because there is an initiative out there, and I'm not speaking for or against at the moment, but the one that I think is referred to as reconnecting to the feds with your exemptions, with your personal exemption, will increase your personal exemption by about 87%, according to my calculation. Now, I don't have it in front of me, but you have it up there, I think. You know, what is a personal exemption? It's 900 and some million or something. And so if you want to change that 87%, now we're talking about tax policy. We're not talking about tax expenditures. Those things I think you as a panel need to be very, very concerned with. I'll just finish by saying this. First of all, it's great. I think you need to look at some of these, get your list, don't have it too long, you know, ones that perhaps are doable, quote unquote. Because it's not going to do anything for revenue, particularly. I mean, let's be honest, it probably will not, at least I don't think it will. But I think it's a good exercise, because maybe we can put this aside a little bit. If you could have what you would, what the public would believe, what your peers would believe, you actually went through this process, you did it, you know, and now let's get off it for a little while. We'll not do this every year. I think there's worthiness in that you really analyze that. And when you analyze it, the standard I want, that I would promote and OBA would promote, is that you put that analysis against the essential services that you as a body are responsible for. I mean, that's the way you have to analyze this. It's not just a matter, you need to have the economic basis in there, but it all comes back to the fact that, yes, it'd be great, we can make a lot of investments, and we can maybe make a case for actually expanding tax expenditures, but if it goes beyond where you can conscientiously provide the services that the state has to provide, then you're getting over the top. I hope you understand what I'm saying there. I mean, it's all about that issue, because the outside panel, I agree with Jim, you know, an outside panel, I think, does bring a nonpartisanship or a non-political to that. But how can they do that in a vacuum? You are the ones that have to make that decision. So, Mr. Chairman, I've gone off a little bit here at the end, but I think that's how I would see it could be very, very useful. Put your list, go through the process, and then maybe sort of close the door for just a little bit.
Questions for Mr. Lindquist. That is our goal, Lynn, is to do exactly that, is to at least by doing an exercise, a one-time exercise, is to have everyone at least delve in to do what Jim did, basically, on the Friday afternoon, is delve in, try to find different ones. We're not going to take a vote, but we're at least going to produce a list of here are some different ideas that folks had. No one voted yay or nay on any of them or pledged support, but these were different ideas of where you could go if you wanted to have that discussion. And I think that would at least effectively get your second cause accomplished, which is to at least close the door on what I think you get pretty universal agreement on, is that there is a lot of myth about the tax expenditure report. This hopefully will provide a little insight into what might be there and what's not there. Thank you. Thank you very much for participating in our exercise.
Thank you.
Mr. Sawyer, thank you for joining us. This what's becoming the afternoon. We're going to hope to wrap up. After Mr. Sawyer, if anyone else would like to testify, there's a sign-up sheet. There's a sign-up sheet. Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Harold Sawyer, and I live in Beaverton. I'm here today really kind of as an outgrowth of an article that appeared in the Oregonian on December 18th, and referring to the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program, and in the headline it had the terms hazy benefits. And that caused me to reflect back to 1967 when that law was enacted. I was an employee of the Oregon State Sanitary Authority at that time, and I had the assignment of developing the implementation of that program. I retired from DEQ in 1994, and I've tried to stay totally away from government ever since. But that reflecting back to 1967, when I felt the purpose, the benefits of that program were very clear, certainly not hazy at that point, but that reflection just brought up some issues with me, and I knew that Senator Deckard didn't exist in 1967. Mm-hmm. So I
it's a strange way
did a stupid thing maybe and sent him an email message with some of my thoughts, and he invited me to come down here today and present them to you. So that's why I'm here. And let me take you just back for a moment to 1967. At that point in time, Oregon was on a major thrust to improve the quality of the Willamette River. New water quality standards had been adopted. Those standards set the target of July 1, 1972 for having the quality of the river improved. We were imposing requirements on cities and industries that were more stringent than those in adjacent states. Significantly more stringent.
For pollution.
Pollution control.
Yeah.
Requirements that were significantly more stringent than other states. The industries that we had at the time, you know, typical example, the pulp mills, some of those required extensive revision of their production facilities in order to achieve the pollution control objectives. These were heavy capital costs. They were competing with industries in adjacent states that were not subjected to those same costs. And the issue that became very significant at the time is, how do you keep the jobs in Oregon, improve the environment, and accomplish these things simultaneously? The Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program became a way of trying to balance that or create some fairness and equity, keep the jobs in Oregon, and still achieve the pollution control. Again, keep in mind that I think for the most part, the standards that were being imposed were more stringent than adjacent states. Come along 1971, 1972, two federal laws were enacted. The Clean Air Act in 1971 and the Federal Clean Water Act in 1972. These pieces of legislation basically set higher standards nationwide. And to a very substantial degree, the standards that Oregon had imposed and began imposing back in 1967 were the standards that were being aimed for with the federal legislation in 71-72. So the more stringent standard for future pollution control investments became certainly less a purpose. There may still be more stringent standards in some instances in Oregon, but I suspect most of the standards imposed today are basically the federal minimum standards. The other fact that existed in 1967 that I think is different today, in that era, you had federal grants to cities for constructing pollution control facilities or sewage treatment plants. Industries that were connected to the city system got the benefit of the federal grant. Industries that were not right in town and on that city system and had to construct their own facilities had no similar benefit. Again, you could produce a competitive disadvantage by that difference in circumstance. And that was another argument that played into the pollution control facility tax credit program. One of those in particular, the food processing industry here in Salem, most of the facilities were connected to the city system. You move over to Staten or other places and they weren't. That produced a difference and a potential competitive disadvantage to those businesses in that sense. That was kind of the background for how the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program came into existence. It was to try and establish a little bit of fairness and equity for these differing requirements. I think one can argue that probably today, if there is justification for the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program, it certainly is not the justification that was there when the program was enacted. The original bill, as I recall, had a sunset provision in it. Facilities had to be in by 1978 in order to get any credit. That's been extended multiple times. My sense is that to the extent that there's a beneficial purpose from it, it has little resemblance to pollution control today. It's probably more the economic development or some other thing that is sort of masked in the terminology. And so maybe the conclusion there is that the name of the program doesn't necessarily equate to the benefit. There was one circumstance that I can remember clearly going back a number of years ago in the early days of the program when we got some tax credit applications in from orchardists in the Rogue Valley for alternatives to smudge pots for orchard heating frost control. And the argument that existed in whether or not to approve those applications, because at the time agriculture was exempted from all pollution control requirements under law. So for a company to spend money to reduce a real pollution problem when it's not a legal pollution problem was an argument that we got into. I felt it was justified that the Environmental Quality Commission at the time approved the tax credits because it was a real benefit, even though it was not required. That element there where a benefit to the public that may not be required or that may be more stringent than a federal requirement or adjacent state requirement may be a justifiable reason to continue some portions of the tax credit program with perhaps limited eligibility rather than just any pollution control facility, even though it's required under federal law and everything else, qualifying for credit.
Mr. Sawyer, based on your experience, if you were king for a day, is that what you would? You have obviously a great deal of experience with the pollution control tax credit, having administered the program. Is that what you would, if you were king for a day, recommend that it's up for expiration, so if we do nothing, it will simply not exist? If you were king for a day, what would you do or have your representatives do?
That's a difficult question for a retired person who wants to see somebody else pay the taxes rather than me. I think there's arguable merit for continuing the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program for those things that are kind of beyond the minimum required or the ordinary. That could be an incentive for developing improved control technology. There are a number of things that could come out of that. But again, you're into a longer-term investment strategy, perhaps, than simply that arguable minor competitive edge because you got a tax credit.
Uh-huh. So, and would you tag it to the federal definition or the federal law? Is that a fair question?
I don't know, and I have not tried to keep up with the standards that the Environmental Quality Commission is adopting now and how those compare to the minimum federal standards. I'm assuming there may be instances where Oregon standards are more stringent than federal minimums. But I don't really know that the majority of the requirements are the federal minimum requirements that are set out in the Federal Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you for getting to me and for coming down to testify. Other questions for Mr. Sawyer? Worked on the Pollution Control Tax Credit Program for a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it. Anyone else that would like to testify before we at least get the 7 or 8 proposals that were put out there today, and we'll put them on a whiteboard? And committee, what I think we'll do, although I'm very open to whatever suggestion you all have, is we're obviously going to, the Interim Revenue Committee is going to tackle affordable housing twice, our next two meetings, one in May and one in early June. If we put out 8 or 9 ideas that have come out of this process, and feel free in the next 2 days, I told the Senate President we would get a list out. It wouldn't be a list that was voted on, it was just a list. So feel free to augment this list in the next day or two. What I would like to do is return to this probably in December before the next legislative session, at least go in more depth into what I think is 8 or 9 different proposals that came out today. And if folks have others, please get them to Paul or I. And I guess my goal would be then maybe return in December to this topic and take a deeper look when it's crunch time for us, or closer to crunch time, of doing the next budget, and take a deeper look at each of those 7 or 8 proposals. Does that sound crazy, or does that sound like a good idea? If I don't hear anything, I think it's a good idea. Okay, well, no further testimony. That's great. We can get out of here early. Paul,
can we go to the whiteboard?
Yeah, if you'd be willing, and I'll just tick off the ones, I think you have the list, Paul, but the ones that I heard, and if folks have, anyone has ones that were not, that don't make it up there, that they feel like at least ought to be examined again in closer scrutiny in December. I had income earned abroad by U.S. citizens, inventory property, welcome Chris, sales source rule exception, deferral of certain financing income of foreign corporations, the life insurance investment income, the expat residential status, the pollution control tax credit, the panning for gold, the cultural trust, the political contribution tax credit. And what, there was one more that I didn't write down.
JL had 3 and only got 2 of them. It was the political and the cultural trust. I think Kip's the third one.
He had another one. Film. The film and video.
Oh, film production.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Peggy. A former resident of Beaverton. So that will be, so we'll compile that list, we'll disseminate it. Senator Whitsitt, if you have a long list to add to that, feel free to augment that.
Mr. Chair, my great discovery, when I got back to Salem, I found that it had already been discovered and fixed last year.
Which one was that?
That was the extraterritorial income exclusion.
Oh, yeah. That was a great topic of debate.
Mm-hmm.
Any,
Are those ones all on this list somewhere?
Yeah, they're on the testimony we got.
I know.
this form here has add pages, three pages long, is the one that Ms. Weimer gave us in the packet. And then there also was another one that was, I think, the same list that came from Oregon.
I realized that they were the overlapping things, and I was just wondering if there was one list that would have all of them.
Not
you
all
have four or five or six different lists, and I was just wondering, if can you check most of them off on this list, Paul?
Yes, and Senator, they should be on this list.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure on the panning for gold.
The panning for gold, I'm actually not familiar with that.
Is it a property tax? What can
I'm not familiar with it.
Well, we'll do some research.
District, Bohemian Mining.
Someone will get a new lobbyist for that. That's one of the good things about doing this exercise is folks get new contracts based on who we put on the list. Other thoughts or questions, Paul, if it's possible next week sometime to just re-disseminate this list and, like I say, make notation that no votes were taken or support was indicated for any of the items.
Yeah,
let folks want to do that.
No, it's true that no support has been asked for yet.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't support all of them, but, you know, they're on your list at the moment.
That's at least we'll return to in December.
In the tape.
Sure, we can send this out and we email it out to everyone, and you have a little bit of description, including we'll find out about this one, and that way you can review it and let us know if that's what you're thinking in terms of that.
Representative Pass brought up that last one, and so I think he gave out a number like $3 million or something like that, but someone may want to check. But I hope the tape does reflect that it was the chair that gave the list. To put up there on the whiteboard.
I was killing time. I mean, I was trying to buy time for Paul to...
Considering part of my constituency will be very interested in the last one,
the Colonia
Mining District.
I think Senator Starr and I are saying, well, your district's changed a great deal in the last 5 years.
I mean, they're in the Rogue Valley. And I guess
thank you. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Chris. Welcome to... the world of revenue, and we will see all of us May 17th down with Senator Witz that will lead that hearing on affordable housing. But anyone of us that wants to attend, we are all, since we are a small committee, welcome to go to vote.
Mr. Chair, before we actually adjourn, I was wondering if you all could just give us whatever dates we may have, because what I heard Representative Butler say, there are these two meetings, and he said there, I got the impression maybe we were scheduled to also meet at another time in June.
June 1st, we'll get the revenue forecast
Right, Senator, the dates for May 17th in Medford,
right.
And we're looking at probably 9 to 3, and we'll have an agenda out to you shortly for that. We're working with the affordable housing folks, and I know they've talked with City Hall in Medford, so that may be where it is, but we'll finalize that for you. And then the next meeting would be 2 weeks later on June 1st, and that would coincide with the release of the June forecast. And then after the discussion of the forecast, then you'd go into the second segment of the affordable housing agenda.
Okay. Thank you.
Have we set the dates for the rest of our meetings?
Have we? Senator, the only other date that we've talked about is that we know that the September forecast will be released August 31st. So that's the one date we know that is out there. And then the chair has talked about a November or December meeting for your kind of to look at pre-session filing of bills. So you'll need to have a work session if the committee wants to pre-session file anything.
So if I could, Mr. Chair,
yes.
August 31st is what we should be tentatively penciling in for that release.
We know that's the release date.
And that's when we more than likely would meet, just like we did today.
We've tried to do them just like, so June 1st will look a lot like today, just the topic won't be. Jim, we added repealing the SIP program, so the topic won't be that.
Whatever.
It would be affordable housing on June 1st. We'll see what comes of those joint summit-type hearings that we've, Representative Butler and I've worked on. Thank you. See you in Medford May 17th. If folks have other topics, I was told we have plenty of ability to meet. Folks have other topics they'd like to get into.
I think, Mr. Chair, one of the things that came up from that last panel is maybe getting outside the box in the sense of not looking at 352 different little items, but maybe the philosophy that we have currently as to the balance, the fairness, et cetera, whatever we want to say, as to individual resources that are required for running the state versus corporate. In the sense of, should we look at the balance? I mean, there's some discussion as to if we're down to, you know, the philosophy now 6.6% on the corporate side as compared to what it might have been in previous decades. Maybe that's something we should also venture at and seeing, because to me that's more the global policy instead of trying to find
discussions, yeah,
four or five different little niche areas.
It's one of my favorite things is getting economists together. Paul knows I love this, so I'm happy to get some dueling economists together to basically present different sides of that argument.
I just think what former Representative Lundquist put on the record is to don't mix apples and oranges. Make sure we know what we're doing. Maybe we should look at both apples and oranges separately.
Noted. Okay. Thank you. See you May 17th.